You're listening to an IOE podcast,
powered by UCL Minds.
This is Research for the Real World. Conversations with researchers about the paths they've taken to shape our everyday lives.
This is Research for the Real World, conversations with researchers about the paths they've taken to help shape everyday lives. Hi, I'm Jason Alargan, executive producer of the IOE podcast, as well as senior digital communications manager at IOE, UCL's Faculty of Education and Society. In this season of Research for the Real World, it's all about mental health. We'll be hearing from researchers whose work encompasses diverse areas such as eating disorders, behavior, and humanitarian emergencies. Today, we're taking a closer look at the science of sleep and the impact it has on quality of life. So, I'm delighted to have Professor Dagmara Dimitriou in the studio. Dagmara is Professor of Sleep Education and Research at the IOE's Department for Psychology and Human Development. Her research expertise lies in, you guessed it, sleep, and its relation to cognitive behavior functioning across the lifespan. Dagmara is also the director of the Sleep Education and Research Laboratory, or SERL for short. Dagmara, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for invitation and to allow me to share all my recent work with you as well.
It's great to have you here. Okay, Dagmara, let's kick things off. First of all, how did you become interested in sleep research?
That would be quite a long story. And if you allow me, I will share some parts of that. So around 20 years ago, I did my PhD at Birkbeck under brilliant supervision of Professor Carmilov Smith, Michael Thomas, and Mark Johnson. So at that time, my focus for my PhD was within the visual spatial area, looking at individuals with neurocognitive developmental disorders such as Williams syndrome, autism, Down syndrome, and also typically developing. So at that time, I feel that I developed a huge deal of expertise within the experimental work because of the interdisciplinary work we were doing there. But when I finished my PhD, I moved to UCL postdocing, examining autism, and I felt that there is something missing there in terms of practical elements, and mostly within the epigenetics, so sort of looking at the environmental factors as well and how they interact with the genetics and physiological outcomes. So this is where I felt that the part that sometimes we all see, the child is tired, the child may not be doing well, and we heard this anecdotal parental messages, oh, my child is just sleepy, my child didn't sleep well. And this is when I started to question, what if a child is not sleeping, therefore is not doing very well during our experiments? We actually never ask these questions. Yet they may have really important outcome on somebody's performance, on different scores, on ability to actually hold their attention during the experimental tasks that we all as scientists carry out. So this is my story when I started to look at sleep. This is how it all started.
Oh, excellent. No, that is very, very fascinating to hear. I mean, it's probably very obvious what the answer is, but in terms of the links between the quality of someone's sleep, how tired they are, has there been anything sort of surprising in your journey in terms of the links between the quality of sleep, fatigue, tiredness, and one's mental health?
The first studies I carried out were mostly within pediatrics. But then I moved on to adults' work as well. And that was partly driven by studies I carried out with autistic population, neurodivergent population. And some of the questions that were asked by parents and individuals themselves who said, look, you are looking at children only. What about us adults? This is when we started working with adults, and that showed that, you know, it's not only about sleep, that they have poorer quality of sleep. For example, in autistic population, they wake up a lot, but that has huge impact on their mental health, their daily functioning as well. Then also, just to provide you more evidence about your question, is it's not only individuals themselves, but their families. So we also worked with collected data with mothers of autistic children who showed to have really poor sleep, obviously because that was impacted by the fact that their child is not sleeping. But in relation to that, we also saw that many of the moms suffer from depression. And I'm not saying only it's mothers. We only looked at moms, but it may be also other caregivers. It could be fathers as well, which still needs to be explored in that sense. So we see a lot of impacts on mental health, and we see a lot of impact on quality of life.
No, that's very fascinating. So yeah, it's a lot to do with sort of, you know, the environment a child finds themselves in, and then yeah, the parents. It sounds like this might lead nicely to my next question. Is this how your lab, the Sleep Education and Research Lab, sort of came to being?
So within our laboratory, we are actually examining vast number of different areas. So where we started, first of all, on pediatrics and some of the work looking at sleep-related learning, and that is partly very much familiar with the whole theme of IOE. We are here to look at education as well. So that was the first stream of our work, looking at sleep-related learning and how that actually impacts the poor quality of sleep, will have impact on the one's performance and daily educational sort of status. But then we expanded that into cross-cultural work. I had brilliant doctoral students from around the world who came from different countries, from Singapore, China, Saudi Arabia. Also, I had master students from Greece and Spain. So from all over the world. So we learned a lot from cross-cultural studies, looking at different environments, how they interact with sleep. So the interactions is actually absolutely, it's beautiful, but at the same time, we ought to take into consideration so many different factors. And then I started working with colleagues from different clinics, so also looking at adults, for example, with anorexia, with cancer. So looking at different areas, but also holistically at families, not only moms and dads, but also at siblings. So for example, if you have a brother or sister who has neurodevelopmental condition, a brother or sister who has medical condition, for example, sickle cell, and I've been working with colleagues from Institute of Child Health looking at sickle cell, and our brilliant UCL, Institute of Child Health, with Fenella Kirkham and her PhD student, we looked at sickle cell and sleep. So you can see that there are so many different areas, but by the end of the day, we all need to sleep, and if we have poor quality of sleep and duration of sleep, that will have huge impact on us.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I on a personal level, I could always do with more sleep. I could also do with a continuous period of sleep. You know, you find myself, you know, maybe sleeping, you know, in bursts of a couple of hours, and I wake up and then fall back asleep, and then I struggle to get back to sleep. And then before you know it, it's time to wake up and get to work.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm curious, Dagmara, you mentioned that your work sort of crosses borders and crosses cultures. When we were getting in touch with you to invite you onto the podcast, you recently embarked on a trip to India. Was that related to any of your current projects?
That's right. So with colleagues, I'm very, very lucky to work with clinicians. As I already mentioned, with Dr. Manga from Imperial College, looking at cancer and quality of life. Then I also am very fortunate to work with charities. And one of the charities who I work with is looking at reducing and preventing mental health problems. So we went to India to look at prevention of different issues, and one of them is actually lack of sleep. So we started to talk to schools, we started to talk to different organizations there to raise awareness about the importance of sleep and obviously quality of sleep, and also talking to schools and teachers and also healthcare professionals as well.
How far along is that project?
That has already only started now.
I'm sure we're going to hear more about it as the project progresses. So that sounds really exciting. And yeah, we're glad to have you in today. So you probably touched upon it, but what are sort of the main focal points and what might be the gaps in your current research?
So at the moment, after COVID-19, we started moving towards focusing more on methodologies, which would be looking at sleep wearables at home, which is absolutely brilliant for us. So we don't need to do a lot of work within clinics, and we can work within one's environment. And this is where the huge gaps are still there, where we tend to collect a lot of subjective data and a lot of data, qualitative data as well. We still need more data to gather from objective methodologies. And we are very lucky. We're in a very, very fortunate times where so many different new technologies are coming out for us. And for example, the new one we are looking at is to carry out studies looking at sleep and cancer and individuals and different treatments. So this is really important in terms of clinical trials and objective data measurements. So these are the main gaps that we are still seeing. But looking at the professor at IOE, I have to say that we still have huge gaps in terms of awareness of the importance of sleep and how to roll out a basic, I would say, short courses for teachers. For us as well, we are working with international students who come to IOE for a year or sometimes 3 years, and the sudden adjustment to different environment, it may not be that easy. Some of our students are saying, I was used to habitually napping during the day, yet now I that is not facilitated, and we have lectures at different times as well. So I think we still have a long way away to the answers about the huge importance of sleep. And luckily, we can do a lot of research, in particular, multidisciplinary research. As I already mentioned, that is exciting work because we can not only work with clinicians, but biologists. The new work looking at artificial intelligence is hugely important for sleep as well. We haven't started working on that yet, but we know that this is one thing that we need to start looking at, the use of artificial intelligence in predicting somebody's sleep or how they can enhance their sleep as well.
I'm going to hang on to that thought about AI, because whilst you were speaking, I was thinking you mentioned things like wearables. Like, I'm wearing an Apple Watch right now, and it's got that feature where it tracks your sleep, and then you can look at, you know, the reports in the health app. In terms of sort of your research methods, do you rely on things like the things on your on an Apple Watch or your Fitbit and take that into account, or do you use some you know, different kind of wearables?
We are using medical devices, which are very, very similar to Apple Watch, and in particular because they have been validated against the polysomnography, which is very, very important in terms of how to track somebody's sleep architecture. Because yes, sleep quality is important, but also it's important to know stages of different sleep. So our cycles, how good they are, rhythmicity of our sleep. So some of the wearables nowadays are absolutely brilliant, exactly as you said, similar to the watches. Somebody can wear it for 7 days and we will know about somebody's sleep patterns during the day and during the night. We have more wearables looking at somebody, for example, people often snore. and that is not a good thing to do. So it can be of concern. So the new technology shows us that we just stick something very similar to a plaster on your chin, and we will have a very good idea if somebody is snoring and has sleep apnea, sort of stops breathing, has poor sort of saturation as well. And there are many more new technologies coming through on horizon. So it's a great news for us.
Yeah. So what aspects of AI do you, I mean, like there's still a long way to go in terms of sort of realizing AI's potential, but what sort of elements of AI can you foresee working well with your field of research? Is it, 'cause, you know, you've got generative AI, that kind of thing, but I'm not sure if that's relevant. Yeah. Would you be able to describe what AI sort of aspects might be useful?
I'm not extremely familiar with AI, but when I'm dreaming, my dream is that we start using AI as a predictor of somebody's sleep and how they can enhance their sleep. So sort of having interface as what we can do with usage of AI for individual. So yes, we have general recommendations for sleep, how long we're supposed to sleep and quality of sleep, but we are also having individual differences. So my hope is that with AI, we will be able to input all the different factors as individuals, which are environmental factors and not only, you know, general factors that we tend to do, age and gender, but also our diet, our activities, our stress levels, and also tools that we can use to protect our sleep. So sort of some people will say, I want to listen to certain music, and I would love to see AI whether it can predict that, well, actually that music was really, really good for your quality of sleep. So sort of giving you feedback. But this is at the moment my dream that I would love to look at.
If anyone's listening, you know, hit up Dagmara in the Searle lab. If you've got some technologies in your locker that might be able to help them out with their research. Let's double back to your sort of focal point of research, and you've already touched upon it. It is the work on prostate cancer. Could you tell us more about this project, Dagmara?
Sure. So this project is with a clinician, with Dr. Manga at Imperial College. And we started to work together quite a few years ago. And that was partly driven by the fact that many individuals with any of the problems, for example, it doesn't need to be cancer, prostate cancer, but it could be breast cancer as well, they will be on a treatment. Now, that is very important to know whether this treatment is having any impact on sleep. Throughout many, many years, individuals with cancer never been asked whether they have poorer sleep. And this is how we started the project. And what we found in our data when we collected subjective and objective measures of sleep, that individuals who were on the treatment, they showed sudden decrease of quality of sleep. And then they also had a few individuals, well over 100 of them, and we published some of their studies. And they usually don't complain about sleep. This is when we started asking them. And we saw huge changes in their sleep, in quality sleep, and also duration of sleep. So our hope is to actually look at different treatments and whether another treatment would actually be more beneficial for their sleep. Because obviously, if they are not sleeping well, they're already on a treatment and they're also worried about the fact that they have cancer. Their daytime functioning is not really good. And they suffer from not only daytime sleepiness, but also from other anxieties, mental health problems, and general sort of tiredness during the day. So another study we started to do, and at the moment there is a pilot study at IOE, we started to run sessions with some of the cancer patients with treatment of cognitive therapy for insomnia for cancer patients. And at the moment, the data is really, really promising. Our patients are improving their quality of sleep throughout the sessions, very similar to our work that was done by Zoe Zambelli, my PhD student, and who looked at chronic pain. So the work we are doing is not only experimental, it's also looking at different recommendations, but also improving quality of life through different sleep managements.
Interesting, interesting. So there's some very interesting ground that you're covering at the moment. Just out of interest, what was the sort of background or the inspiration towards sort of focusing on folks who are undergoing cancer treatment?
For many years, as I already mentioned, I worked within pediatric area, but I also wanted to look at children who would have medical conditions. So some of them, with my colleagues, we examine individuals with cerebral palsy, but I always wanted to look at cancer as well. Because obviously, when you are suffering from medical conditions such as cancer, sleep is crucial. It's ever so crucial for somebody to benefit from good quality and quantity of sleep. So your treatment outcome may actually be enhanced. And as you know, we work within our different teams, and I was lucky enough to know really well one of the professors who passed away last year, sadly, urology, Professor Paul Abel, and within his team, individuals work on prostate cancer. And this is how I started working with Dr. Manga, and we started looking at quality of life. And that also, what we would love to also do in future is actually looking at subgroups of individuals who suffer from prostate cancer who are neurodivergent. Because obviously they are forming a huge group, and we would like to see how actually their sleep patterns are as well and how we can improve those sleep patterns.
Got it, got it. You've just come back from doing some work today in relation to the project. What does a typical day like that look like?
So the patients are absolutely lovely, I have to say that. Absolutely lovely patients. And they are very, very forthcoming to talk about their sleep nowadays. They know me quite well for quite a few years. And when they come to the clinic, they talk to the clinicians, and then I speak to them about their sleep. And many of them will actually give us really good data in terms of their daily functioning, but also provide us with their own struggles in terms of not only sleep, but how that impacts their daily life and how we can actually try to feed in some of their ideas and their proposals into our future work. And this is how I feel nowadays. It's brilliant how we can engage with patients with prostate cancer. And I also had for quite a few years, I worked with autistic individuals who were employed on our research grants as well. So they were able also to interact and provide us with ideas. So the daily routine sort of would be that they would be providing us with the sleep questionnaires. And as I said, some of them would be willing to do the objective measures. Actually, quite many of them, they are very, very eager to take the wearables home so they can understand as well about their sleep patterns.
That's very fascinating. And like you were saying, that they're eager and enthusiastic about you know, being participants in the research. It just makes me think they seem like, because, you know, they're going through something very serious right now, and they seem to really appreciate someone taking an interest in what they're going through. And perhaps it sort of takes a bit of a weight off their mind to not worry about what's going on and sort of have that distraction. Is that what you're seeing?
Some of them may be worried that, you know, I don't think I dream. I don't think some of them will be asking questions about sleep, because we must remember one thing. Not often we are asked about our sleep. When I lecture at IOE or I lecture anywhere in any other departments, institutes, I always ask my questions. How often people ask you about your sleep? Not often. And if you have children, how often your general practitioner will ask you about your child's sleep. Not often. Yet everybody can say something about their sleep and how it changes throughout their life and how it can be impacted in different ways. And by the end of the day, when we start reflecting about it, we understand as humans that sleep can have really, really detrimental effect on our daily functioning. And everybody can give example that if I don't sleep, what can happen if I drive? What can happen if I'm taking exams? And what can happen if I'm lecturing, if I am sleep deprived?
Yeah, it's so relevant to our everyday lives, regardless of how well you are or unwell you are. Sleep is absolutely so key. I was wondering if this was a relevant question to ask, but how do sleep and prostate cancer or cancer generally influence each other? And what is the impact of hormonal treatment? And I think the hormonal treatment is an aspect of your research. What's the impact of that on sleep patterns?
So the interaction, I don't think we are at the stage that we can say much about interaction. What we do know that when we compared two different cohorts of individuals, those who were on hormonal injections and those who were not, we had big, significant differences in their sleep. So those ones who were on hormonal injections, because they suffer from hot flashes and sweats, they will be waking up at night, their quality of sleep is diminished. That doesn't happen with individuals who are not on hormonal treatments. Now, the exact mechanism how that happens, I don't think we are at this stage. And this is why we started examining individuals on hormonal injections. And there should be, and this is what we are trying to do, is to design different randomized control trials looking at different treatments and whether different treatments would have less negative effects on the sleep. I think we must remember that treatments for cancer, and I'm not a cancer specialist at all, they are now becoming equally good. What we would like to see is for different cancer treatments to have less negative effects on, for example, sleep. And if there is a negative effect of sleep, that obviously has cascading effect on quality of life. So this is what we are seeing, that the theme that the new studies emerging towards quality of life. And this is what I, as I mentioned, is quality of life in prostate cancer, quality of life in chronic pain. We would like to see the central part of that to be sleep as well, and how we can amend certain treatments to enhance sleep.
Thank you for that. In, I guess, a final question to sort of wrap up the work you're currently doing. In terms of research outputs, do you sort of have a particular vision as to how the research outputs might be implemented in sort of a practical or in practice?
For example, the work that was carried out by Zoe Zambelli, who did a PhD on chronic pain and sleep, she has put quite a few different recommendations for NICE guidelines for healthcare professionals to offer different treatments, such as she has done for her PhD, and worked beautifully. She showed huge improvements in quality of sleep when she carried out cognitive therapy for insomnia. There's another interesting aspect that I started to look at with US Army is to enhance your sleep at night and enhancing your learning throughout the night. At the moment, it was a small pilot study where individuals, healthy students, would be learning certain patterns before sleep. And then we would be, during phase sleep, and especially slow wave sleep, which is very much related to our learning, we would be inputting those signals through tactile stimuli to enhance their learning. we do have enough understanding that throughout the night, our brains are still really active. So throughout the night, we are actually rehearsing a lot of information from the daytime. So what we would be hoping to expand the studies, not only to healthy individuals, but to individuals who are having certain delays in learning, and that sleep would actually sort of provide them with additional learning abilities, and certain stimuli would be able to trigger them as well. But this is still very, very premature sort of area that we only started looking at that.
It sounds very conceptual, but very exciting, that's for sure.
It still needs a lot of interface, a lot of work. And as I mentioned before, AI and etc. We are at the... So I think we are just... You know, I said I've worked in sleep area for about 20 years, but I really think this is just now the moment that all the different areas, multidisciplinary areas, are actually merging together. And we are having more and more technology that we can do more and more in terms of enhancing somebody's sleep, but also providing somebody with better treatments as well. And use of e-health, where I feel that is going to be future for a lot of individuals, in particular in remote areas or in different countries where, for different cultural reasons, one would not go, or cultural or lack of organizational reasons, somebody cannot go physically to see healthcare professional, but they can use e-health.
That is so fascinating, Dagmara. You've got a lot on your radar. Is there anything else that we may have missed?
No, I think we haven't. What I just feel that in terms of policy making and recommendations, as I mentioned, I briefly mentioned about individuals with autism or autistic or individuals or neurodivergent. During lockdowns, where everybody was complaining about their sleep, how poor their sleep was and mental health, our study was probably one of the most positive studies. We found that when we had autistic individuals in the UK, they showed in their data that their sleep during lockdowns improved. And that could be taken by the fact that they didn't need to go out to stressful environments where, you know, we are all rushing, commuting, and at the same time it's really busy, you could be late somewhere, and all these different interactions where sometimes they are unwanted interactions. And when they had during lockdown very, very structured days, but they could work from home, their quality of sleep was brilliant, was much better, which led to better daytime functioning. What we would like to see from this kind of studies that employers are more flexible as well for neurodivergent people, because if their daytime functioning is better and they sleep is better, they will be providing better work for them as well, which is very successful.
Dagmara, it has been really interesting to get to know you and all about your research. I wish you well on your future projects. So thanks for coming onto the podcast today.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You can follow Searle and Dagmara's work on X, the website formerly known as Twitter, at UCL Searle. That is spelled UCLSERL. Some of what we've covered today is also available in the episode notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, we have an archive of 21 past seasons. Search IOE Podcast to find episodes of Research for the Real World, as well as more podcasts from IOE. And a quick favour before you go. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, we'd really appreciate it if you could give the IOE Podcast a rating. 5 stars would be nice if you're enjoying the show, and that will help us to reach more people who are interested in hearing about such important work. Thank you for listening.
Research for the Real World is produced by IOE Marketing and Communications and IOE Research Development. The theme music was created by Rob Cochran. Tatiana Sotero-Diaz is a series advisor, Amy Leibowitz is a series producer, and Jason Ilagan is the executive producer of the IOE podcast.
Thanks so much for downloading and listening to this IOE podcast.